Here are just a few of the ingredients in an average box of chocolate cookies. Enriched flour with thiamine, mononitrate, partly hydrogenated vegetable oil, caramel color, cocoa processed with alkali, invert sugar, monocalcium phosphate, cornstarch, soy lecithin, and, rather mysteriously, artificial flavors. Now, if that doesn't make your mouth water, food additives are the subject of today's edition of Please Explain. And joining me now are two experts who will take your calls later in the program. Dr. Wahida Karmali, the Director of Nutrition at the Irving Center for Clinical Research and Associate Research Scientist and Lecturer in Dentistry at Columbia University Medical Center, joins us again. And Dr. Joe Schwartz, a professor of chemistry and director of McGill University's Office for Science and Society. He's the author of several books about science and nutrition and was the chief consultant on the Reader's Digest best-selling Foods That Harm, Foods That Heal. Very pleased to welcome you both to Please Explain.
Thank you.
Dr. Karmali, we tend to think of food additives as a 20th century phenomenon, but haven't humans been tampering with and altering the food supply since ancient times?
Absolutely, you're right. We've been using this tradition of adding substances to foods for centuries. If you think of how salt was used to preserve meat and fish, or how vinegar was used to pickle vegetables, or sugar was added to foods, herbs and spices. Yes, it's centuries old tradition.
But not monocalcium phosphate.
That's correct. As we begin to learn more about chemistry of substances and how you can extract actually substances from foods and put them back in foods to do a variety of things like preserve, flavor, blend foods, thicken foods, color foods, and also add some nutrients which makes up for any nutritional deficiency in the society.
Dr. Schwartz, as unnerving as it might be for those of us who are not chemists to read the label like the one I read for chocolate cookies, food and the preparing of food is all about chemicals and chemical reactions in the first place, isn't it?
It certainly is. Everything in the world, of course, is composed of chemicals, and it's an understanding of chemicals that I think liberates us from panic. There are a lot of people who just look at a complicated-sounding name and think that it must be dangerous because it is multisyllabic. But you cannot tell anything about the danger or the safety of a substance by the number of syllables in its name. What we have to do is study the substance, take a look at what trials have been performed, and come to some kind of legitimate conclusion based on the scientific evidence.
But when we make chocolate cookies at home, we are not throwing in thiamine mononitrate and partly hydrogenated vegetable oil and caramel color and artificial flavors. So that's one of the reasons people get suspicious, isn't it?
Yeah, but you're certainly throwing in some fructofuranosyl glucopyranoside, and that's just sugar. So, you know, you can't start to get scared because the name sounds complicated. And each of the ingredients that you listed there is put in there for a specific purpose. Lecithin, for example, is an emulsifier. It allows oil and water to mix. The thiamine is a B vitamin. It is put in for fortification purposes. So each and every additive really has to be looked at on its own merit. And then you take a look at the overall composition of the food to see whether or not it merits eating.
Dr. Karmali, what are some of the main additives used to preserve foods beyond salt, sugar, and vinegar?
I just want to add something to what Dr. Schwartz said. I wouldn't actually support the use of hydrogenated fat. So people do see that. It means that this fat is high in trans fat, and it's really not good for your cholesterol. So if you see a product with hydrogenated fat, it's a red flag because it's really not good for you.
Trans fats in general are not good for us. What are the fats that are okay for us?
Well, if the unsaturated fats, the monounsaturated fats that you would get from olive oil, canola oil, or nuts like almonds and pistachios, they are the fats that you can use. And there are also some polyunsaturated, which come from also a little bit from canola and olive oil, but also from corn oil and soybean oil and walnuts.
But don't they become more saturated after we heat them up?
No, you don't make them saturated. What you do is very high temperatures, you can oxidize them, and that's not healthy either. So there is a combination strategies that we need to follow to when we get the food into our households, into our refrigerators, to take care of it so they are safe, prevent them from contamination, how you handle food, prevent any sort of cross-contamination, and also cook in a way that retains the nutrients to get the benefit of the food we eat.
So let's get back to the question I asked you about preservatives. What are some of the preservatives other than the most obvious ones?
We also have other antioxidants like BHA, BHT. These you will find on several food products. Also, propylgalate.
Well, what are BHAs and BHTs? I've always been afraid of them.
Well, I'm sure Dr. Schwartz can give you the chemical background, but what it stands for is butylated hydroxy toluene and butylated hydroxy anisole. So these are antioxidants. In fact, they are on the GRAS list, which is generally recognized as safe. So the FDA, the Federal Food and Drug, has told us that it's okay to use them.
And so, oxidation is a problem. Oxygen, which we need to sustain life, is the thing that destroys foods in time?
Well, it can combine with the food to make it more rancid. So we need to prevent the rancidity and the spoilage of food. And that's why these preservatives are used.
Dr. Schwartz, let's look at sulfites. They seem to be everywhere in cereals, wine, dried fruits. What are sulfites and what do they do?
Sulfites just may be the oldest class of food additives that have ever been used. The ancient Romans and ancient Greeks used to burn sulfur and collect the sulfur dioxide gas that was produced and used it to preserve wine, because wine can be contaminated by rogue yeasts, for example, that will sour it. And so it has a very long history of use. Of course, just because it has been used for a very long time doesn't mean that it has always been safely used. And there certainly are people who react to sulfites. You can react to very, very small amounts of sulfites, but in almost all cases, the people who react are asthmatics. And about 5% of asthmatics will have a reaction to sulfites. The places where you're most likely to encounter them would be in dried fruits, apricots, for example. Wine, of course, is a classic source. But sulfites are also sometimes used in the processing of flour, because it tends to change the structure of gluten, which is a protein that is found in flour, and it makes for better baking qualities. Generally, though, even the sulfite-sensitive people will not react to such trace amounts, but it has happened. And unfortunately, there have been some fatalities here. Sulfites probably are the only class of food additives that have actually led to people dying. Of course, obviously, it's a very rare thing, but it can happen. We have to remember, though, that people have died from eating peanuts and fish, and there are naturally occurring substances that can have a dramatic effect as well. In fact, far more so than the food additives.
Although there are people who believe that the growing allergy levels toward peanuts and other nuts may be as a result of eating some of this stuff.
Well, the allergies are directly proportional to exposure. And the more substances we have in the environment, the more things we're exposed to, the greater the chance that you will develop a reaction. And indeed, as we eat more and more peanuts and peanut-containing foods, the incidence of reactions increases.
What about sodium nitrate? Aren't some people allergic to that? And haven't they been called carcinogenic?
It's not an allergy. Sodium nitrate is a completely different issue. Sodium nitrate and its metabolic byproduct, sodium nitrite, are very commonly used in hot dogs, hams, and various kind of cold cuts. The reason that they are used is to prevent botulism poisoning, which is one of the most horrendous types of food poisoning. Botulin is one of the most toxic substances that we know. Same substance that is sometimes used by doctors to try to get rid of wrinkles. Of course, it's injected there in tiny doses. But it is a horrifically toxic material, and sodium nitrite can prevent the growth of the organisms that produce this toxin. However, there is an issue here, and the issue is that in the body, nitrites can react with naturally occurring chemicals called amines to form nitrosamines. And nitrosamines are animal carcinogens and quite likely human carcinogens as well. So what does this really mean for us in terms of consuming foods that are high in nitrite, you know, like the hot dogs and cold cuts, etc.? And when I get asked this question, my usual answer is that there are far better reasons to stay away from those foods than the nitrites, because they tend to be high in saturated fat, high in salt, generally poor in nutrition. And you can't avoid nitrites in any case, because the vast majority of our exposure to nitrite comes from natural sources. Nitrates are present in all kinds of fruits and vegetables. Nitrate, of course, is a commonly used fertilizer. And in the body, nitrate is converted to nitrite. So we are exposed to this whether or not we consume hot dogs and cold cuts or not. So I think it's, you know, we have better reasons to curb our intake of those foods than because they contain nitrites. Although I should also point out that the industry probably uses more nitrite than is needed to prevent botulism. And the reason for that is because nitrite also renders the meat kind of pinkish. If you saw a hot dog or a salami, which is not nitrited, the color would be gray, and that's not a very marketable color. But nitrite reacts with a compound in meat called myoglobin to form nitrosomyoglobin, which has a pink color. So there is a cosmetic reason that they add it as well. And this means that they probably add more nitrite than they really need as a preservative.
Dr. Carmelli, what about nutrients, things like calcium and vitamins that have been added to food? Nowadays, there's all that orange juice that has calcium in it. If we have a normal diet, do we really need all of those added nutrients?
What we know from our diet surveys is people are not getting enough calcium and getting enough vitamin D or zinc, iron, etc. So whatever is deficient in our diets, it's been put back into foods to enhance, or actually in as an orange juice, it's fortified with calcium to give people another option to choose a food that they may enjoy having. You know, some people just don't like milk or allergic to milk or cannot tolerate the sugar in milk. So it's just another choice that people can have.
Dr. Schwartz, what about the additives that enhance flavor? MSG and we know about salt, but there are all sorts of other things, these
right.
artificial sweeteners, for example.
Well, MSG is one of the more controversial additives in food. MSG stands for monosodium glutamate, and it's what we call a flavor enhancer. Nobody knows exactly how it works. Some people suggest that it causes you to salivate more. Others say that it somehow increases sensitivity of taste buds. But MSG itself has no taste.
It comes from seaweed?
It comes from seaweed originally. That's why Chinese and Japanese cooks for millennia have been adding seaweed to food in order to flavor it with MSG. Today, we don't need to extract it from seaweed. Today, it can be produced industrially by fermentation processes very, very cheaply. And it is commonly added to a large variety of foods, very often processed foods, or to Chinese foods. Indeed, the time that the public first became aware of this issue was back in 1969 with a letter to the New England Journal of Medicine written by a physician who coined the expression Chinese restaurant syndrome because he himself suffered from headaches and sweating after eating in a Chinese restaurant. And eventually concluded that it was because of the monosodium glutamate that they added. MSG can trigger such a reaction in some people, but again, the incidence of this is much less than people think. There's been a lot of publicity about it, but the documented cases indeed are not that many. And if you know that you're sensitive to this, well, you just learn to stay away from it. But again, I should point out that MSG exposure does not only come from its use as an additive, because monosodium glutamate occurs in nature. Tomatoes, mushrooms, for example, are high in glutamic acid. That's the reason we add them to so many foods. They bring out the flavor of other foods because of their natural glutamate content. But you never hear of people speaking about having a Chinese restaurant syndrome reaction to a pizza, because, you know, they don't make that connection.
Yeah.
But it can happen.
Well, we have to go to a break in just a moment, and we'll be taking calls when we come back. But I just want to touch on one more thing Before we do that, Dr. Karmali, what about food dyes? What's the difference, for example, between yellow dye number 5 and yellow dye number 6? And why do we even need those food dyes? Is it for the same reason that we put those nitrates into, is it nitrates or nitrites? I can't remember. Into the hot dogs because it would look less inviting if we didn't?
Yeah, these different colors, first of all, are very well regulated. You know, there is there's no way that somebody can stick a color into a food and get away with it. So we have very strict regulations, and the colors are there to certainly to make the food more inviting. You know, you would probably choose certain foods because they have that little pigment that makes it look better. I mean, sometimes pigments have to be removed. They use bleaching agents, like, for instance, in white cheese. You don't want any yellow pigment in it. So you can go either way. But these are definitely tested. And there's ongoing research. You know, nothing is etched in stone. So if there is some science that shows that something that we thought was okay, but it's not really good, it definitely should be, it is removed from the market.
Well, where do they come from? I've heard some food dyes actually come from Peruvian beetles. Is that typical?
I think they come from all sources. They can come from plants. There are, for instance, the annatto. It's a yellow coloring that comes from the annatto dye. And sometimes spices are used to color foods like turmeric or cayenne pepper, etc. So these can be plant-based, and they can be just chemicals or, you know, tree-based, etc.
Well, I'm happy when turmeric is used because I gather it also helps us to fight cancer. So in that case, we have an additive that might actually have a very positive effect. We have to take a little break. And when we come back, we will be, in a little while anyway, we'll be taking your calls at 212-433-9692. Talking with Dr. Wahida Karmali, the Director of Nutrition in the Irving Center for Clinical Research and Associate Research Scientist and Lecturer in Dentistry at Columbia University Medical Center. Also, Dr. Joe Schwartz, Professor of Chemistry and the Director of McGill University's Office for Science and Society. Stay with us. We're back with Please Explain. My guests are Wahida Karmali, the Director of Nutrition at the Irving Center for Clinical Research at Columbia University, and also Joe Schwartz, Professor of Chemistry and Director of McGill University's Office for Science and Society. And we are taking your calls at 212-433-9692. Let's go to Richard from Jamaica Hills. Hi.
Hi, I have a comment to Dr. Karmali and a question. My comment is that you had mentioned that it was perfectly all right to use various additives because they had been approved by the FDA. And my comment is that approval by the FDA in the past has shown itself not to be a guarantee of the safety of quite a few products. And my question has to do with aspartame. I remember when it was first introduced that there was quite a hubbub about it because they had noted that under high temperature it would break down into toxic ingredients such as formaldehyde. And I also have read on the internet that the FDA has received numerous complaints about adverse reactions to it. So I would like your comments about how safe it is to use.
Okay, thank you for your call. First of all, we have to understand that, you know, we don't live in a risk-free world. So we have to look at benefit versus harm, and that's how they look at research, if, you know, we need to put something in or whether we can recommend anything to our patients, our consumers. And it's, you know, science is evolving. It's not that we have the final word on anything. So as it evolves and we find there are harms associated with any substance, it raises a red flag, and we know we cannot consume that substance. I think the FDA has a monitoring system. You know, patients can call in, physicians can call in to report of any adverse effects.
But, you know, the FDA is not the only organization that is testing these things. And I just happened to get this today from BBC News. It says the artificial sweetener aspartame is not linked to cancer, according to a report just released by the European Food Safety Authority. Now, I don't know if they're any better or any worse than the FDA, but that would suggest that that the research continues to find it safe. Now, whether it tastes as good as sugar is a whole other matter, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, I think we really, you're right, we don't have the scientific evidence to say that it causes cancer. There are a lot of anecdotal stuff around, you know, that you will find on the internet, but we really have to look at the science to see if it's safe or not safe.
What about all those other artificial sweeteners? There are so many out there now.
Can I just comment on one aspect of this?
Of course.
The caller raised the formaldehyde issue about aspartame. And this, of course, is all over the web, people claiming that because it breaks down in the body, it's formaldehyde, which is toxic, embalming fluid, etc. Almost all of this information comes from people who are not scientists and who have various agendas. Most of the stuff on the internet about aspartame is just absolute nonsense, including the formaldehyde business. Yes, it does break down to release formaldehyde, but formaldehyde is found in numerous foods. If you drink a glass of tomato juice, there's more naturally occurring formaldehyde in there than there is in a glass of diet drink. An apple has formaldehyde. It also has acetone, which is nail polish remover, or isopropanol, which is rubbing alcohol, naturally occurring, but they're there in very, very small amounts. And the fundamental law of toxicology, as first formulated by Paracelsus, alchemist in the Middle Ages, is only the dose makes the poison. So it makes no sense to talk about formaldehyde as being there. It depends how much and what the toxic levels are.
But can't it build up? Can't it build up in the body,
no,
or
it doesn't. It doesn't.
We get rid of it as it comes in?
It is eliminated very, very efficiently by the body. The body has numerous systems, of course, mainly the liver, with various enzymes that break down these foreign intruders, and the byproducts are eliminated. Now, I'm not actually a big fan of artificial sweeteners, so I'm not kind of coming to their rescue because I don't think that diet drinks or soft drinks of any kind should be a major part of the diet. They don't serve any purpose. They don't add any kind of nutrition. Even the ones that are sweetened with artificial sweeteners may just increase the like for sweet things. I don't think that's a good thing.
How are they even built? What is the difference between these artificial sweeteners and natural sugars?
Well, there are several different artificial sweeteners that are on the market depending on which country you're in. For example, in Canada, we have cyclamate, which is not allowed in the U.S., which just shows you that different countries come to different conclusions, and the evidence is not all that conclusive. Aspartame is very easily made in the laboratory because it's made from phenylalanine and aspartic acid. These are two common amino acids, and it's a very simple laboratory synthesis. Saccharin is also a synthetic substance, very readily available from industrial sources. But there are natural sweetening agents out there too. Stevia, people may have heard about, which is an extract of a plant. It isn't used as an additive, it's not allowed, but you can use it as a tabletop a sweetener. And then there is sucralose or Splenda, which is one of the newest ones. And that is made by taking sugar, ordinary table sugar, and by chemical processes replacing some of the OH groups, hydroxyl groups in the molecule, by chlorine. And this makes it unabsorbable by the body, so it just kind of goes straight through.
Allotame is a brand new one, isn't it? Same sort of thing?
Yeah, exactly. And another new one is Neotame, which is basically a more modern version of aspartame. One of the problems with aspartame is that people who suffer from a rare genetic disease called PKU, phenylketonuria, can't consume it, certainly not early on in life, because they cannot metabolize phenylalanine, which is one of the components of aspartame. And Neotame is not associated with that problem because it doesn't produce phenylalanine.
Let's go to another call. Vivian from Queens. Hi, you're on the Leonard Lopate Show.
Hi. My question has to do with the bovine growth hormone that is in milk and subsequently, of course, in milk products like cheeses and cream or whatever. And the companies, for example, that say our milk we get from farmers who pledge that they won't put this in the milk that we buy or we sell to you. My question is, how do we know for sure that that isn't in there? And doesn't the fact that bovine growth hormone is a growth hormone, isn't that making us all fatter if we do consume it? And what can we do about it?
The bovine growth hormone is really not added to the milk. It's given to the animal to increase milk production. And naturally, meat and milk do have a little bit of this growth hormone. And by feeding the animal, it doesn't mean that the growth hormone content of the milk increases. Because this is another protein, it gets digested. And so it's really not going to, you're not going to get more of it in the milk.
But there are a lot of nutritionists who are disturbed by these growth hormones coming through our bodies. Why is that?
I think we need to understand, you know, look at the content. The content is not supposed to increase in milk. It's supposed to increase milk production. I think that's what we need to remember. And I think if, you know, there are choices out there. There is organic milk or farmers who say they don't use it. So there are choices for people. It has been looked at very carefully, and it's considered to be safe.
Well, okay, well, you mentioned the organics. Now, there's all kinds of different organic labels now. The Food and Drug Administration says this one's certified organic, this one is natural, this one is organic, and it's all very fuzzy as to what is actually really 100% organic and what we can rely on that doesn't have bovine growth hormone in it.
Yeah, I think, well, first of all, we have to understand the term organic. Everything we eat is organic. But how organically it's grown, that's the key, or if the milk doesn't have any antibiotics or BST added to it.
People also insist that the cows be grass-grazed rather than be grain-fed because cows are natural grass grazers.
There are standards. Just to answer your question, there are standards, and farmers who... you know, get certain amount of income. Everybody's subject to these standards. So there are standards about what you can put in the soil, what you can spray with, and what kinds of fertilizers you can use. So there are standards that they have to follow.
Let's take another call. Rahini from Long Island. Hi.
Hi, how are you? I love your show, and thank you for bringing these wonderful guests.
Well, thank you so much for saying that. And what's your question?
My question is about mono and diglyceride. I see that listed on a number of products, especially ice creams and cakes. I get tremendous headache because of that, so I stopped taking those products. And I also noticed that the better ones, like, I don't want to name any names here.
Sure, name them.
Name them? Okay. When it comes to ice creams, Ben & Jerry, they Haagen-Dazs, they don't use this mono, the substance. Whereas I found out by eating Turkey Hill ice cream that it had this, and I saw a pattern, then I stopped taking products with this ingredient. My question is, why do they have it? Can we stop them from adding it to the products?
Okay, well, I would say that the chance that you are reacting to mono or diglycerides is bordering on zero. So whatever you're reacting to is something else in those foods. Mono and diglycerides are just fats. And any time that you eat any kind of fat, it is broken. The fats, generally in chemical terms, are called triglycerides. Uh-huh. Why? Because they are made of a common backbone of a molecule we call glycerol, to which three units of fatty acids are joined.
But Dr. Schwartz, why even include them in ice cream? The premium cream ice creams don't include them, and if you make it at home, you don't need it.
Right. It increases the shelf life. The reason for that is that ice cream is really a mixture of fat and water, ice crystals and fat. That's what ice cream is. And as you know, fat and water don't mix very well. If you know, oil and vinegar, of course, will separate out, right? In order to make sure that this doesn't happen, that there's no separation, you add substances we call emulsifiers. And these glycerides are emulsifiers. But you consume glycerides all the time. Anytime that you eat any kind of fat in your body, it converts to glycerides. So whatever headaches you're getting, I would suspect is due to something else in the ice cream. It's not due to the mono or diglycerol.
Well, what might be in the ice cream that causes headaches?
I have seen a pattern. And also, if Ben and Jerry doesn't have to use it, why does Turkey Hill have to use it?
Well, emulsifier, there can be different kinds of emulsifiers. So they may be using a different kind, like something from seaweed called carrageenan can be used as an emulsifier. So there are. It's not that that you have to be dependent on mono and diglycerides to give this, prevent the separation in the ingredients.
But doesn't Ben and Jerry's, don't Ben and Jerry's and Häagen-Dazs and some of the other ones use a lot more fat? They have a higher fat content, and perhaps that takes the place of the emulsifiers. The emulsifiers are replacing all of that cream, and there's a trade-off.
Yeah,
the trade-off
right.
is that you're getting a lot more fat in your diet when you eat the better ice creams.
Yeah, the more fat you have, the smoother the product. So you need less of emulsifiers to keep it together.
Our number here, by the way, is 212-433-WNYC. That's area code 212-433-9692. Dale Deutsch from Stony Brook University. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, good afternoon. Enjoying your program. And every time I buy a quart of pickles and I see these yellow dye in it, I always say, oh, I wonder why that's in there. And while you were talking, I'm a biochemist, but this is not my area of expertise, but while you were talking, I went on the computer and went on PubMed, and I looked up mutagenesis of these food additives. And, for instance, it was a group of Japanese workers, so it's called Sasaki and all, and they published they called a common assay with 8 mouse organs, results with 39 currently used food additives. And they said many of these caused damage to gastrointestinal organs and other organs. And they included some dyes and some of the even BHT and BHA and some of the sweeteners. So now, and I don't know if this is definitive, but I was wondering, what's your opinion? Do you think we have to do lots more studies on these to see if they're safe on animals or not?
We have to do lots more studies on everything, including the natural ingredients in foods. See, the body doesn't distinguish between additives that are artificially made or natural compounds in foods. It's all a question of what the molecular structure is and how it interacts in the body. And certainly there have been issues with some food additives the same way that there are issues with natural occurring substances. Lectins in kidney beans, for example, can kill you if you don't cook the beans properly because they will agglutinate the blood. So, you know, you've got to look at each one individually, and you can't just paint with a broad brush. You can't condemn all food additives because some have been shown by someone in some lab test to be mutagenic. There are numerous naturally occurring mutagens in our food supply.
Thank you for calling us, Dale. Dr. Kamali, what are anti-caking agents and anti-foaming agents?
Anti-caking agents are added to something that's a powdered product or a granular product to help it to flow freely, because you don't want salt to cake or form lumps, you know, because that's not interesting. So those substances are then added to help it to flow freely.
And what are they?
There are a couple in the market, and one of them is you can even add like the binders to it, but the one that's added to prevent caking is like a silicate, a calcium silicate that you can add to prevent lumps being formed in this granular, even like confectioner sugar. You don't want lumps in it, so you can add this anti-caking.
And it doesn't affect the quality, and it doesn't affect our bodies?
It's not shown to affect the body. It's fine to use it.
Well, one of the things that I'm always afraid of is the propellants that they use in whipped cream cans or those cheese cans that mm-hmm. you spray out. Dr. Schwartz, are they safe for us?
Well, the propellant that is used in whipped cream is nitrous oxide, which is laughing gas.
Well, then I should go to the dentist after I have some
exactly.
of that whipped cream.
Exactly. And nitrous oxide is one of the best tested, of course, of all food additives because of the medical connection. And as you know, nitrous oxide has been used since the 1800s to as an anesthetic gas. That doesn't mean that there are no possibilities of adverse reactions, because anything in a high enough dose can cause a problem. And there have been cases where people have purchased whipped cream and have basically sprayed it into a garbage bag and then put their head into the garbage bag to inhale the nitrous oxide to get high and have passed out. So, I mean, do we blame nitrous oxide for that, or, you know, do we blame human behavior for that?
My big concern is that it never tastes as good as real whipped cream, but that's a whole other matter. Gary from Port Washington, you're going to have the last word here.
I just want to comment on sulfites in wines, and do reds and whites have them? Why are they added? And anything you have to say, what's the purpose of sulfites?
Okay, well, thank you. As I understand it, sulfites occur naturally in wines, but then people add more. Isn't that true, Dr. Schwartz?
Yes. You add more in order to make sure that the wine doesn't turn to vinegar.
And is that a good idea? Isn't it because there are some winemakers who very proudly announce that they don't add sulfites?
Yes, they just rely on the natural sulfates, which are produced by bacteria, which are also converted then in the wine to sulfites. It can be done. You certainly can make wine without sulfites, and people who have a sulfite sensitivity can look for wines that are not sulfited, but there's no guarantee that they won't have a sulfite reaction because, as I said, it can occur naturally as well in the wine.
Although the ones without the sulfites added tend to be the more expensive wines.
They tend to be. They tend to be, yeah. And, virtually all wines really are sulfited.
Now, we've been talking about additives. Would genetically modified produce also be considered to have additives, or is that a whole other area?
No, that's a completely different category. And there, are, of course, are many different modes of genetic modification. So once again, you can't lump them all into in one category. For example, in some cases, crops may be equipped to make them resistant to a herbicide, so that you can spray the field and kill the weeds without affecting the crop. That would be one modality. Another one would be to implant a gene into corn, for example, that allows it to produce a protein that wards off insects. But each one of these is tested, and before it is allowed into the marketplace, of course, studies have to, FDA in the U.S. and Health Canada has to be satisfied about the risk-benefit ratio. You can never guarantee that there's no risk.
And there are a lot of people who are very suspicious, especially in Europe, less in this country. We're pretty much out of time, but I wanted to end with Dr. Carmali. What are the, when you talk to members of the public, what are the most common questions you're asked or concerns that you hear about food additives?
I think people just get so confused when they see these long names that they cannot pronounce, and they feel they're all artificial and not good for you. So I think that's the biggest concern. I also like to just to say that, you know, we think of additives only when they are sort of intentionally added, but there are also those indirect additives that you can get from food packaging. And any packaging material is also very closely regulated.
But there are, in other words, there are concerns sometimes people have about plastic leaching into their food when they use it in the microwave.
That's correct. That's why, you know, when you use plastic, make sure it says in the label that it's safe for the microwave.
We thank you both so much for being with us, Dr. Wahida Carmali, Director of the Nutrition in the Irving Center for Clinical Research and Associate Research Scientist and Lecturer in Dentistry at Columbia University Medical Center, Joe Schwartz, Professor of Chemistry and Director of McGill University's Office for Science and Society. He's the author of many books and the chief consultant on the Reader's Digest bestseller, Foods That Harm, Foods That Heal. Thank you both so much for being on Please Explain today.
Thank you.
Thank you.